Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN. Good to have you with us, gang. We're going to get straight down to business because there is a ton to talk about. Who better but Iron Mike to put us in the picture? Mike, man, good to have you back. But listen, we got good news and bad news to start with. So which way do you want to go?
You better start with the bad news. Beyond not having me on video, I mean, that's got to be bad.
That's the devastating news that I still can't come to terms with. So I'm not even thinking about that. We'll start with Dak Prescott news, of course, which is on so many levels really upsetting. He's gone for the season, surely. Ankle injury, needing surgery, is the latest as we're recording this. We'll look at the implications, Mike, for Dallas's season in a moment. But does this injury mean that Dak's future as a Cowboy is seriously in doubt?
That's a really good question. And, you know, it's awfully ironic, isn't it, that they've been trying to get a deal done or not trying to get a deal done for his future. And he has been leading the Cowboys in a kind of Russell Wilson way, boom or bust behind Dak, because nothing else seems to be working particularly well for them. And then now he goes down, and Andy Dalton came in and played very well within that offense and has weapons. Now, obviously, Dalton's not your long-term solution to any problem, and Dak offers things, lots of things that Andy really doesn't. But he is the kind of guy who, if Jerry Jones was saying, well, in the end, I don't want to pay a huge amount of money for a hobbled Dak, who's, you know, and I think looking at that, he may not be ready by the start of next season. That's going to be a long rehab, you know.
So what does that mean for his contract? So just to recap, obviously, he's franchise tagged at the moment. And he suggested there was long protracted contract negotiations that the deal didn't get done. So this clearly gives leverage to Jerry Jones, right?
Somewhat. The problem is, of course, given the situation now, it's going to be a real question to franchise him next year. Mm. And we saw it with Kirk. Just think back to Kirk Cousins. You don't want to keep franchising quarterback because then you're paying him probably more than you would if you gave him that long-term deal.
Right.
And Jerry may be hesitating about the guaranteed money or whatever. So the one thing I think that might work against Dak is if Andy Dalton plays well the rest of the season, they could look at Dalton as a Ryan Fitzpatrick kind of guy. In other words, we can draft a quarterback and then, or, you know, there aren't going to be, I don't think, any game breakers on the free agent market that, you know, would be better than Dak at a cheaper cost, and then have him get us through one more year while we bring another guy along. On the other hand, you know, what you've got is pretty good. Certainly on the, you know, if not in top 10, on the edge of top 10. And you can probably get him back at a bit of a bargain after the injury. In other words, you might be able to persuade his agent that to lessen the guarantees and kind of put a prove it kind of clause in there for a year or so. So it's going to be fascinating. And of course, the key is something that none of us know is what Jerry Jones is thinking about this. Because if he were really committed to Dak, he would have thought he would have sewn him up before this season.
Now, on that, Mike, was the challenge the level that Dak was playing before this season, in that the money, and this is always the way, of course, when you're the most recent contract to be done, sometimes players are elevated beyond their ranking because they're the most recent deal to be done. But you look at Mahomes and Watson, and Prescott, in most people's eyes, was below those two, yet his agents were looking for that kind of level deal. Then you fast forward to the first 4 weeks of this season when Prescott was leading the NFL in pass completions, in attempts and passing yards. Had he elevated his performance until he got injured this season into that elite crew?
It's an interesting question because the Cowboys were 1-3 coming into this game and probably should have been 0-4. You know, they had that great comeback and Dak certainly, you know, is a big part of that and engineering that. Same thing against the Vikings. I thought they caught a couple of really good breaks all around, not just in officiating, but you know, to come back and win that game. And you can argue about whether the Vikings should have kicked a field goal and made it, you know, get the 2-point conversion just to tie. But that's academic. So the jury's always going to be out on him. I think you could argue that given performance, Dak is at a level with Deshaun Watson, given, you know, the body of performance. And this is a good indicator of why it's hard to take a quarterback out of a team context. We talk about quarterback wins and quarterback this, but, you know, if Deshaun were in Dallas's situation and Dak were in Houston, would both, you know, I think maybe both teams might have been better, right. Strangely enough,
right.
given the coaching and all that was in place. So, he's certainly not a Mahomes. He's always, you know, part of the perception will always be influenced by the fact that he was not a first round pick. And I remember going back to shows that we were doing together and I was saying how much I liked Dak. And I think he was the third best quarterback in the draft. And if I remember right, he went fourth of the, in the draft, and he's already better than, you know, so I just think it's a fascinating story. Because as I said, we don't know what Jerry Jones is thinking. We don't know what Stephen Jones is thinking. Maybe he's the one who, maybe Stephen Jones has an 8-year-old son who makes these decisions. I don't know. You know, in the real world, you would have thought they would have sewn up Dak or moved on. And by giving him the franchise tag, you almost get the feeling that they wanted to wait and see.
Yeah.
Like buying a Christmas present, you know, and knowing receipt. You can send it back.
Right.
You know, it's a very strange thing. And I don't know how you could make an offense more quarterback friendly than Dallas has tried to do.
Right.
I mean, injuries
right.
have gotten in the way, but you've got receivers, you've got a good running back. You had a great offensive line and, you know, it's not as great anymore. And you've got a defense that's got more holes in it than a trendy teenager's jeans.
You know? on the Dalton, you mentioned as backups go, he's as good as they get.
Right? Yeah, what a good pickup that was. Yeah. I mean, you know.
So does that keep him very much in the running for the East then? Because we know, we've talked about it, Mike, on the show, that it's demonstrably the weakest in football this season. So an 8-8, 9-7 record could well take it. So
absolutely.
Are they still the favorites in the division then with Dalton?
They were favorites to begin with. I think they're still favorites with Dalton. The Eagles are kind of in and out. And they've been really hurt by injuries. Wentz is still somewhat inconsistent. They've got problems up front. But, you know, I'm looking at the Dallas thing, and, you know, the Giants had 8 penalties for 80 yards, and Dallas had 3 for 25. So Dallas survived losing time of possession, losing turnovers. I guess they were a little better on third down. They had more first downs, more yardage. But, you know, that was the kind of game where – one break the other way makes a huge difference.
Right.
The fumble, Daniel Jones's fumble, was the real thing in the game. They're not that good. The defense is awful. You can run through that defense. And if the Giants had had Saquon Barkley, I think given the way they were playing, that would be a different game. But they have to be favorites in the East, you know. The Rams have already beaten all 4 teams in the NFC East, so we should just declare
them the
champions of the NFC East and you know, make the other guys just chase a wild card.
I was getting worried early on in the game yesterday. I messaged you at one point and said, how did I not see the Jason Garrett revenge tour coming? Because the way they started.
And it's funny when you said that, you know, because I'd been looking in the pregame where they showed the shot of Garrett, you know, embracing Jerry Jones, who didn't particularly look happy to be doing that. You know, maybe he was worried about the 6-foot distancing or something. But almost pulled it off. It would have been a great thing if he had, and then that would have been our headline. You know, rather than Dak being injured, which is a horrible thing to see, and it's a horrible injury. And a lot of people this morning were coming down hard on Tony Romo on Twitter, which is not like coming down hard on Tony Romo on the field, but. Because Romo was saying maybe he thought that it was a pulled calf muscle because Dak was rubbing his calf. But of course, that was what he was seeing. And it wasn't until they got the head-on shot from the sideline camera that we saw the way his foot was bent.
Right.
And then, you know, as soon as that came into sight, everybody knew that it was a really serious injury. But to me, the strange thing was Dak was showing no apparent pain. He must have a very high pain tolerance because, you know, he was rubbing that calf. He knew something was badly wrong, obviously, but, he didn't seem to be suffering that much. And, you know, it's always horrible to see a bad injury like that.
Well, it is, but that segues nicely into a more positive story, because speaking of bad injuries, Alex Smith, of course, suffered one of the worst we've seen in years. 17 surgeries he required, Mike. I didn't realize it was that extent. And at one point, and if you watch the ESPN documentary, you'll know that sepsis, and there was fear that he might lose his leg at one point early on in the whole process. And then here he is yesterday, suited up and back under center, taking snaps for Washington. And of course, his offensive line duly stepped up to the occasion and allowed him to be sacked 6 times, which is really spirited of them. But what a story. What an incredible story that is. And Mike, talk us through what next for Alex Smith, based on what you saw last night.
That's a good question, because we didn't really see very much, did we? Alex Smith, back when I remember saying that I thought he was a pretty good fit for Jay Gruden's offense,
right?
Which had a lot of short passes, a lot of quick release passes, and that's what he was good at. But he was also a very mobile quarterback. You know, he had played for Urban Meyer, and in an offense that required the quarterback to run a lot of options and things, and that was his other strength. It didn't seem to work out that way before he was injured in Washington, and now with Ron Rivera there, I don't know if he's a fit for that offense as well. I was kind of surprised that they demoted Dwayne Haskins and didn't have him active. Although, you know, they were saying that Haskins was sick, had a stomach bug or something.
You buying that? Do you think it's more?
Not really. I think they just wanted to, you know, have a veteran ready. And Allen, you know, Allen is what he is, as we saw last year in Carolina. And the problem is he doesn't have much arm strength, and neither does Alex. Neither has Alex, really. And we didn't see anything to suggest that had changed. But I think that the main thing wasn't injury as much as simply the layoff and getting back to the speed of the game. And that's going to take him a couple of weeks if he becomes the starter. It's not like he's been around the game for all of that time he's been out. It's 2 years where most of the time was spent rehabbing. And he's got to catch up with a new system, a new coach, and with the game itself. But, you know, one step at a time, and I'm sure he's not going to be daunted by what happened out there. You know, if he gets sacked fewer than 6 times, he's probably in better position.
It's progress.
A position to run as much.
Right.
And, you know, and of course, having done a Super Bowl with Alex Smith, therefore we're best buds. You know, he's one of the nicest guys I've ever worked with. Present company accepted.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
And, you know, just really straightforward, really honest about his own performances and his place in the game. And I think probably a more talented quarterback than people realize, you know, if he had gone into a better situation. And again, I keep saying it's hard to take quarterbacks out of the context that they're in.
Right. Well, even if you flip that back to Dak and, you know, how...
Yeah.
He landed in the right place, and an injury to Romo dealt him a kind hand, and he took that opportunity. It's a great point. And Smith's career has always fascinated me, because if you're the number one overall pick, look at what he's achieved. And, you know, last night, the latest chapter in that, he's had a 10 plus years at the top. He's been, as you say, a consummate pro, instrumental in Mahomes' development. You know, Mahomes cites him as a major, major reason why he's reached the levels that he has. And yet, in many respects, he's kind of player in many people's eyes, and an abject failure. And it's all about perspective, right? I look at what he's achieved, and it's a hugely successful individual, but yet he's got this...
That's really true, you know, and I think he played better in San Francisco than the way he left town suggests. They wanted to go in a different direction with I think the big thing was downfield arm. But yeah, perception, when you're the number one pick overall, the perception is you're supposed to be a superstar.
Right.
When, you know, with quarterbacks, superstardom comes and goes year by year, and there's very few who manage to stay in that position on a regular basis. And a lot of that involves winning. I think Tom Brady, in a different context over the years, would be, you know, if he had come into a starting job, which again, like you were saying, you know, Brady got to his starting part by injury to Drew Bledsoe. Had he been on another team that, you know, was less able to take advantage of him and his biggest skill, I keep saying to people, I mean, he's a great quarterback all around, but his greatest skill was his adaptability. There was no Brady style of game like there was a Peyton Manning style of play. Brady was able to adapt to whatever game plan Bill Belichick came up with, and those things changed week by week, not season by season like most teams do. And that was his big, that was his biggest strength. But if he had played his whole career in Tampa, he wouldn't have played his whole career in Tampa. He would have been at Tampa, and then he would have been cut or traded, and he would have been picked up somewhere else, you know. Right. And he might not have gotten into a starting job with any team, given that he was a fifth-round draft pick. So, you know, it really is a fragile kind of balance that we have when we evaluate quarterbacks.
Onto the game specifically, Mike, the Washington-LA game. Business as usual for the Rams after their kind of spluttering, scrappy performance against the Giants last week. McVay dialing up some really creative plays once again. The way he used Gerald Everett, I thought, was particularly interesting. You know, in lots of different ways, mismatch central. And it felt like LA have got their mojo back offensively. One stat that really stood out that I'd like you to elaborate on, 169 yards after the catch the Rams had yesterday against Washington. So what does that tell you about this offense, that the 2.0 McVay offense that he's building?
Yeah, and that's what the offense is designed to do. You know, similar in a way to what San Francisco does. The big thing they want is those yards after the catch. Saying since the Super Bowl game in particular that they needed to involve their tight ends more. Obviously they, you know, this was specific against Washington because Washington's big strength is up front. And,
right.
And I thought it was fascinating in this game that they only sacked Goff once, but the Rams got 8 sacks, you know, so all those first round picks up front there for Washington didn't really deliver what they're supposed to do.
Would you deal Aaron Donald for all those first round picks?
No, I don't think so. Donald has been a beast the last couple of weeks.
Hasn't he?
I'm not sure if it was something in the media that sparked him up or something. That I remember one of the mouth clowns was saying that Darnold wasn't that good. He was all reputation and all right. You know, and no performance. But he's become relatively unblockable. certainly by one guy, it's a real problem. And again, if you go back to that Super Bowl, one of the keys of the New England's win in the Super Bowl was that they were able to man block Darnold. Joe Tooney basically man blocked him, and there was a great moment toward the end of the game where Donald was saying, you know, that's on me. I was only, they're not double teaming me. I should have got that to that, you know, and,
when he's mic'd up. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was great. But, I thought, you know, doing this without, they got Cam Akers back, which made a difference to them. Certainly having someone who can run with a little bit more explosiveness than Malcolm Brown or even Henderson. And Henderson had a fairly good game.
He's done well standing in, hasn't he? I mean, they've got depth there. But Akers, yeah, tell me what you thought about Akers, because he's so, you know, highly touted rookie. We'll talk more about
he's got a bit more explosiveness than Henderson does. Mm-hmm. Henderson's kind of easily stopped on runs. And when you watch highlights, you'll see Henderson get one or two big gains, which is great. And he's okay as a receiver as well. And he had a touchdown running and a touchdown receiving. But I think Akers gives that kind of slash thing, sort of like a Kareem Hunt, more of a Kareem Hunt type than those guys. And more of a Gurley, what they used to get from Todd Gurley. The interesting thing was they came 3 yards away from quadrupling Washington's offense, which I don't think I've ever seen before. Not that I've looked at that stat I just happened to be doing it.
It's your favorite stat, isn't it? Yeah.
But they had 429 yards of offense, and Washington had only 108. Wow. So, yeah. You know, 432, and they've quadrupled Washington's offense. It's hard to lose a game if you can do that. Mm. But they played on the East Coast in Buffalo, and they had a bad start, and then they came back from 28-3 down and nearly won that game, but for Josh Allen and for that contested interference.
The flag, yeah.
And if they had won that game, they'd be undefeated, and that would have been, you know, people would be talking about that as in the same way as the Patriots 28-3 comeback. You know, it would have been the great comeback of the season. So, yeah, I just think all around the Rams do seem to have a bit of that mojo back. It's great to see Robert Woods catch long passes, because that's kind of what they need. You know, they are missing a deep threat that they had with Brandon Cooks, who had a really good game for Houston this week.
Did.
His first one of the season.
About time.
But, you know, Woods, Cup, and a third receiver who's a deep threat is a lot different than Woods, Cup, and a third receiver who's a similar kind of intermediate guy like Reynolds is, for example.
Now, you mentioned the 28-3 comeback. Let's move on to Atlanta, Mike, because, of course, the Falcons are the wrong end of that. And I guess that was at the beginning of the end, really, wasn't it, for Dan Quinn and Thomas Dimitroff, the GM, both who've gone, because they never managed to rebound from that, and no surprise they couldn't.
It's really strange that a team can, you know, come back from a Super Bowl, being in the Super Bowl, and we know Super Bowl losing teams often have less successful seasons the next year, but to go on that kind of a run, consistently and to burn so many leads is really strange. And this to me was the hardest game to pick of the week. I kept vacillating between Carolina and Atlanta, because I do like a lot of the things that Carolina is doing, and Mike Davis week by week sort of steps more into that Christian McCaffrey.
That is fascinating, isn't it? The way that he is just obviously not at precisely the same level, but not far off. I mean,
and nobody would have thought that. You know, Mike Davis was kind of looked at as a not a power runner, but a kind of inside runner, hard runner, and teams let him go because they didn't think he had that kind of all round. But he had I think it was 150 yards of total offense last week. And when I saw Todd Gurley running, certainly his best game of the season. Not quite running like Todd Gurley of old, but
not far off.
But not that far off. Yeah, I thought, okay, this is the why I in the end I picked Atlanta straight up.
But also Julio as well. I guess did you pick him thinking Julio was gonna suit up?
Yeah, and that was part of it too, and that's a huge loss for them. But I thought, okay, they're going to get some of that back now, you know, some of that offensive prowess. But, you know, it just seemed like every time they had a chance to get back in that game, and Carolina had a halftime lead, something would go wrong, and Matt Ryan was not making plays, which I think is something you can kind of say season long, or maybe even longer, that Matt Ryan somehow has took that loss personally.
Yeah. I think you're right.
But that the weaknesses that were revealed, say, in Atlanta's game, and the loss of Shanahan as an offensive coordinator, I think are the two things that go along with this Atlanta demise. And the third one would be the failure of Dan Quinn to consistently play defense the way they did that year, which was not great, but it was good enough with a high powered offense to survive. And yes, they had injuries.
Yeah. They've been unlucky with injury. And again,
Deion Jones was hurt. Keanu Neal was hurt in the year after the Super Bowl. So that hurt them. But basically he keeps trying to build a Seattle style defense without the same ingredients that make Seattle's so effective, which is partly pass rush and is partly that big physical secondary.
Can you make connections there? Is this too simplistic and too trite, but in the same way that a lot of Belichick lieutenants have...
That's me, simplistic and trite.
I thought you'd appreciate it on a Monday morning. The fact that a lot of Belichick lieutenants have tried to do the same thing, tried to magic up the recipe elsewhere, and do you feel that Quinn is maybe tried to do that and kind of copy that Carroll?
Yeah, Caldwell with Jacksonville, Saleh in San Francisco to an extent. comes from Seattle, and right. It's really hard to recreate. Even Seattle's had trouble doing it, since the Legion of Boom, because it was a really good combination of players who fit the system perfectly, and it's hard to recapitulate that once you start losing those players or you try to recreate it. And to an extent, you build your system around the personnel you've got. And to an extent, teams have caught on to a lot of the things that Seattle likes to do with bringing down that strong safety with the corners playing press, in effect, press man on the outside. But everybody in the league plays that way of defending. I've talked about this for a couple of years now, where you don't have to run step for step with the receiver up the sideline. What you do is you run behind him, and when he turns around and puts his hands up, you start slapping away at his arms. you paw at him, basically. Mm-hmm. And you get away with it because they won't call it, because they say you're not gaining an unfair advantage by doing that. But right. that's the way most coverage is now, and it's taught by most teams, to play the eyes, to play the hands, and not look back for the ball, not play the ball if you're in that position, especially when you're in man, not zone coverage.
Mike, the Falcons are 0-5 now with that defeat. That's the first time they've gone 0-5 since 97. Quinn and Dimitrov, are you surprised that they cleaned house and both went?
Not totally. Although I always think it's harder to fire your GM than right. it is to fire your coach, depending on what you've got lined up, because presumably the guys in the front office aren't in conflict with your GM philosophy wise. So you're kind of, you're kind of in the same position. But what this means is they start over next year with a new style of play, depending on who's made GM. And therefore a rebuild of a team. I would not even think it's outside the realm of possibility that, that Matt Ryan would be on his last
leg. I was going to ask you. Yeah, he's 35 now.
It depends on I suspect they'll go for an offensive-minded coach who might have a reputation as a quarterback whisperer, which means in a nightmare scenario, they hire Adam Gase when he gets fired by the Jets. I wouldn't wish that on anyone, even in Atlanta.
Let's talk about Dan Quinn's old side, Seattle, who improved to 5-0. Should Mike Zimmer have taken the chip shot field goal?
Well,
close the game down. That's what everyone's asking, and it's easy in hindsight to say shit.
Well, it would have made it a 2-point conversion to tie the game. It wouldn't have closed the game out.
Yeah,
I probably would have kicked the field goal. Mm. But I can see why Zimmer did it. Because the ball was at the 6-yard line, and therefore they have a longer field to come up. So he was in effect playing to win. If Madison gets that first down, then they use up most of the rest of the clock, because it was right at the 2-minute warning, and the game's over. So I think it was worth that in terms of risk and reward. Mm. I actually thought on first glance that Madison had made it.
He got it.
But he did get driven back pretty promptly by about 7 guys. So I can understand why that wasn't given. I thought, again, this was a game where Seattle might have caught a couple of breaks. I'm not sure that both of those Kirk Cousins fumbles were fumbles. Where they said they weren't incomplete passes, but. Seattle was playing swarming. Again, when the game breaks down, Russell Wilson, when it's fourth quarter, you're playing playground football. and DK Metcalf and Lockett are both very good at that. Metcalf in particular has been exactly what they drafted him to be.
Let's talk about that.
He went down to the second round because people said, oh, he can't run pass patterns. Well, he's learned to run better pass patterns than he did in college, but he's also still what he was in college, which is amazing physical guy right. who can win 50-50 balls, who can beat people yeah. with speed, who can beat them with strength. So he is what he wants. And, you know,
well, Wilson talked about him as saying he could be one of the game's all-time great receivers. And you look at that final drive, right? So they, as you said, it was less than 2 minutes ago, 1 minute 57 to be precise. 94 yards is how far they drove. There was a fourth and goal where he fires it into Metcalf, which was the sixth of the plays on that drive that went to Metcalf. Is he one of those players, Mike Metcalf, that would elevate, Wilson's a superb quarterback, would Metcalf elevate an average, an indifferent quarterback as well? Is he that kind
of... I'm not sure, because again, that's still, it still isn't his strength. You know, if you put him in a highly pattern, I mean, if you put him on like San Francisco, and you just told him to run those crosses and drags that San Francisco run, he'd probably be awesome, you know, and yards after the catch. But he fits that kind of breakdown game that they always wind up playing in the fourth quarter. And they don't play a sort of structured pass offense in the same sense. They really want to be a running team and then make big plays downfield. So he's perfect for that. In some offenses, I think he might well be wasted or possibly overlooked, the NFL being a funny thing. But put him on Minnesota and... You know, you would probably, Minnesota desperately needs someone to take the pressure off Adam Thielen. And, you know, that was what they had such a good pairing with him and Diggs, because Diggs isn't really that deep threat, but he can do it. And he can run the crosses. He can run the short patterns, you know, and Thielen isn't really that deep pattern, that deep threat, but if he's single covered, he can do it.
Don't they hope Jefferson is that player though?
That's what they're hoping. Yeah. But he's going to take a little bit of time, I think, to come along. And with Cook out, Minnesota's going to have a serious problem now. You know, Seattle in that game too was 0-for-7 on third down. I'm keeping track of this over the season, just to third down doesn't really tell you much. I mean, it can tell you some things in retrospect, and they were 2-for-2 on fourth down, which makes them 2-for-9 on conversions.
Okay.
And only being in third down 7 times is good in a sense, but you know,
right.
Minnesota had almost 40 minutes of possession in that game. So it was almost 2-1.
Well, that was, I mean, the getting the ground game going, and you mentioned Dalvin Cook going out, but they still kept it going with Mattson coming in. And that was against a Hawks run D that has been pretty stingy for most.
Yeah. And you know, in the fourth quarter, I thought Seattle was gassed, you know, because Boone even had a couple of runs,
right?
You know, in that last drive that Madison did, which is even crazier that you think that they couldn't convert short on third or fourth down, you know, inside in the red area. And, you know, maybe it's play calling. Maybe you have to try something different. But, you know, I just have the feeling that, no, they didn't want to put the ball in Kirk's hands in that situation. And what receiver were they going to go to apart from Thielen, you know, unless they could get Rudolph wide open somehow, you know, which is probably what I would have tried, to be honest, play action, tight end blocking down and then releasing out. But it was going to be tough. I thought Minnesota were really hard done by in that game.
Well, right. They
were. It's a shame they couldn't pull it out.
1-4 now, Mike.
Yeah.
So they're essentially done, right? Or are they? Or do they? Well, they look at that performance and, you know, without overemphasizing it, no one else has run on Seattle the way that...
Well, I mean, if you told me that Minnesota, even like they are, and I wasn't predicting Minnesota to be, you know, this is Green Bay's division, but Minnesota's 1-4 and the Bears are 4-1. Mm-hmm. And the Bears are kind of what defensively Minnesota usually is. In other words, you know, they're a really good defensive team, and they can probably, you know, they can probably get to the playoffs with this, as I wrote on Friday, you know, this kind of Kyle Orton, Rex Grossman style quarterbacking.
Yeah.
Because I'm not convinced that they're actually better than that, you know, at quarterback.
Yep.
So I think Minnesota is pretty much out of the running, unless, as you said, Jefferson steps up now that Madison's going to be the number one running back. I don't think Madison's the receiver Cook is. And I think they're going to have more problems going along. And Seattle, they've been lucky to be 5-0, a couple of lucky wins. But that's how you get there, you know.
That's it.
You have to have the run of the green go your way. So,
well, let's talk Raiders next.
Raiders, then. Yes.
First win.
I couldn't believe I was rooting for the Raiders
since 2012. Derek Carr said, "Mike, it's about time." I've had a lot of painful memories in this place. I wonder what your memories of Arrowhead have been, Mike.
Yeah, the interesting graphic they put up was the Chiefs are 28-3 against the rest of their division. Everybody always whines about the Patriots and their division.
Right. I mean,
that's pretty impressive since Mahomes was there.
He gets a lot of stick, John Gruden. I think he played this game well. Like, he balanced. We've got Booker running with Jacobs and Carr taking shots and two big drives as well. And we saw this with the Patriots and Belichick's MO against them with just a lot of clock eating drives. The first drive, 11 plays, 6 minutes. They had that big one in the third as well, which was 8 minutes, the Jacobs touchdown drive. I think Gruden called a good game here.
I think Paul Gunther called a good game.
Fair call.
On defense more than but yeah, I mean, that's the kind of game he wants to play. He wants to be a run first team and taking the shots. And they ran the ball over 30 times. Mm. I think the two tailbacks had 30 between them. And so that was, that was part of this recipe for success. I agree. They watched what the Patriots had done. And the Chiefs have, I hesitate to say this because I harp on this quite a bit. But last year, I thought they had, again, like Seattle this year, they had a couple of really good breaks in each of their big wins at the end of the season against the Patriots and then in the Super Bowl. Which is not to take away from the amazing comeback against Houston or for the fact that they won those two games in the end. But they didn't look that good against the Patriots last week. And I'm sure Raiders looked at that and said, look, this is a team that if we do things right, we can beat. And they kept the ball on the ground. Ruggs stepped up, another rookie receiver.
Somewhere in football heaven, Al Davis is watching that performance with
exactly.
Stogie in his mouth.
Okay, you go long. And it was like, whoever was doing the commentary said, he was past the defensive back before the defensive back had even turned. He hadn't even got out of a shift, switched his hips. So, that was.
Yeah, how does your theory about defending work against Henry Ruggs III, Mike?
Yeah, you better give him some space.
Right. What about Trayvon Mullins, Mike? I mean, because this was the key. It's all very well saying we know how to beat the Chiefs, or a recipe to beat the Chiefs is, establish the ground game, dominate possession, and make sure you've got a lot of speed in your backfield, in your secondary to match up with them. But again, the latter point is fundamentally predicated on having that personnel. Trayvon Mullins was superb. Is he one of those players now that is emerging as one of the best corners in the league, do you think?
Yeah, and I think what Las Vegas did really well was to penetrate from the outside in and for the most part keep Mahomes in the pocket. Mm-hmm. He had a couple of instances, including the touchdown run, where he didn't. But you saw them do a really good job of controlling him while he was running and not give him easy throws or easy alleys to a vision when he was running. And at the same time, they played kind of inside out from the linebackers so that Kwiatkowski, was able to defend a bit. And they kept most of it in front of them. Now, they were lucky, obviously, that they had a touchdown called back on what was probably the best throw weekend from Mahomes to Hill, best throw and catch. But Osemele is the one guy who the referees apparently are allowed to call holding on the Chiefs, while everybody else is, while Eric Fisher is like bulldog headlocking guys along the line of scrimmage.
Well, everyone in the league, right? So we're not going to call any holding.
I mean, it's funny because, again, we had this anomaly between a couple of games with a lot of flags, a couple of games with imbalanced ones. And a couple of games with hardly any flags, and I saw an interesting pregame with Mike Pereira basically saying, yeah, we're not calling anything, but I like that game because it's the offenses are rolling, you know, and everyone wants to see touchdowns. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if you do that, then why don't we just go to the Arena League rules, you know, where you can only play, you can only line up directly on the linemen. You can't blitz anybody and you can't stunt or twist anybody. You just have to play straight up one-on-one pass rush, you know, or have everybody count to three Mississippi like we did in switch football. You know, if that's what you want, you know, why? And then they call these ticky-tack, Fred Warner had one, you know, ticky-tack roughing the passer call.
Yes, yeah, yeah,
oh, well, the top of his helmet might have grazed his chin
yeah.
strap, you know, and something like that. And I hate inconsistency.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kel Surprise, we're talking about officials being inconsistent. But on the roughing the passer as well, like when it's so clear and demonstrable that players, there's nothing vindictive, there's nothing intentional, there's not any suggestion, they're moving their body to avoid it, and that's still given as well. That drives
yeah.
me.
Yeah, that was the one in the Patriots game where they called it on Mahomes, where the guy is I thought he's going to get called for a forward horse collar. Because he literally had Mahomes yeah. like around the neck from the front and trying to pull him forward back yeah. to him to keep him up on his feet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Mahomes was going down. You know, he knew what was going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So but on anyway, Monday, Mike, that's. But I mean, I thought the Raiders were, you know, were really brilliant. There was a moment in the game where it might have been the interception that Carr threw, where you could see Gruden kind of going, David Carr, you know, underneath yeah. his mask.
Derek Carr. Well, he might have been saying David Carr as well, but.
Oh, yeah, Derek Carr.
Both of them.
But the I thought the Carr's pass to Renfrew was probably the play of the game.
Mm.
Apart from the one that was called back, the Mahomes one, the Hill, you know, because I just thought he showed patience. He avoided the rush, and he still got the ball in to Renfrew, who wouldn't have been open had he not been able to do that. That and Ingold knocking Breland's hat off. they threw him that little swing pass, and Ingold had to get a first down, and Breland had him, and he put his head down. And knocked Breland's helmet off and wasn't called, obviously, because he's the runner. But, you know, Breland had that good interception. He was all
over. Yeah. Our friend, we chatted to Breland opening night, if I remember rightly. Ollie, yeah. The producer was with me on that one. Yeah, it was a good chat as well. He's a smart cookie. 9.7.
He's a little less smart today than he was yesterday.
Yeah. By tomorrow, he'll be back to normal. 9.7 yards was the average depth of target for Carr. That's the highest he's posted under Gruden. So a lot of positives.
And you know, that probably irritates him because everybody says he can't throw deep and he can't throw long. And, you know, the ability to connect deep is not necessarily the ability to throw 50 yards. As we saw with Ruggs, it's, you know, it's to see where the throw is and get the ball there, so the receiver can take advantage of it.
Great point.
You don't have to have a Mahomes arm,
to
be effective. I mean, you won't be as great, but you can still be effective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good point. The other thing, it's interesting you talk about Gruden and how he was behaving and what he was saying, at least we think he was saying on the sidelines. There were times, at least a couple of times, when he's with Carr. And he's reminding me more and more of Tony D'Amato. I don't know if he's modeling himself that. I mean, it would be quite a textbook Gruden retro throwback as well, but there were times when he was talking to him, it looked like it was Pacino talking to Jamie Foxx in Any Given Sunday. It's really reminded me of that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think Gruden is running that reputation, you know, of quarterback whisperer and offensive guru and all that all that kind of stuff, and sometimes I think it actually gets in the way of effective coaching. I think Carr's probably on a relatively short leash in some ways.
Has been from the start, it seems.
I know, and it's funny because they're committed to him, and you know, and probably the negativity is counterproductive in some ways. He reminds me a little bit of Kirk Cousins in Washington, in that no matter how well he plays, he never seems to get the credit, and whenever they lose, he gets the blame.
Yeah, that's a great show.
I like him better than Cousins, though, but that's another story.
All right, speaking of other stories, let's move on. We've got to take the Browns seriously, surely.
Oh, yes, indeed. I had, like I said, I had them to win that game. They were, I don't know what the final line was, but at the point I looked at it, they were getting a point and a half.
I think it was one. I think it ended one, landed on one.
Yeah, they were still home dogs, though, which I thought was strange, because good as Indy's defense is, like we talked about at the top of the show. No, we didn't, because that was when I was talking to Ollie beforehand. But Rivers has his limitations, especially now. You don't have to really game plan for Rivers. And the Colts are short-manned on offense without Marlon Mack. They're still trying to find a way of putting those receivers together. And I thought the Browns, their defense was primarily based on pass rush, which is not a bad thing with Rivers, since he's not particularly the most mobile guy. Although he still, can make some time for himself in the pocket. But, right now, Taylor's not a Marlon Mack kind of back. Who's his second receiver after T.Y. Hilton, who doesn't really seem to be his first receiver either?
That's the big question.
Marcus Johnson is his second receiver.
No strength in a tight end either. And it's worth pointing out, though, that Costanzo is out, which a lot of people keyed in on as an issue, and Miles Garrett definitely.
Well, with Garrett, that was one of the reasons why they were keying on pass rush as their attacking way. They Indy play really good defense, and that score, I took the under on that game, as I said. It turned out being a 55-point game, but 7 of those points are Ronnie Harrison's pick six, which Rivers never should have thrown. Unless he had an arm transplant during the week and got Patrick Mahomes' arm. And 7 more was Isaiah Rogers' kickoff return, which was a thing of beauty. And somebody was saying, I'm glad we're legislating kickoff returns out of the game, because I really hate watching 101-yard kickoff returns. They're so uninteresting as plays,
So how seriously are you taking Cleveland, Mike?
Pretty seriously. I would take them very seriously if Nick Chubb was still playing. I said somewhere else last week, I'm still not sold on Baker Mayfield. I think Mayfield has to be handled very carefully, and he can make plays within a certain framework, but not within another. So if you can contain Baker Mayfield in the pocket, you have a better chance against them. And even as it was, Landry and Odell had 9 catches but were targeted 18 times, and Hooper had 5 catches and was targeted 10 times.
Right.
So the 3 leading receivers were basically 50% with Baker, and that could be a problem going on. Now, the fact that they can run the ball and their offensive line is solid enough, their tackles can keep Mayfield alive, and the inside 3 is really good. That's going to help them a lot, because they had 35 minutes of possession against what is a pretty good defense, and was actually statistically was the number one defense in the league. So that, if you have 35 minutes of possession and you only get 2 penalties and, you can go at 10 better than 50% on third down, you ought to be able to win a lot of games. And they'll do that. Now, they're in a tough division. That's their biggest problem. And it was at the start of the year when people were pumping the Browns. Both Baltimore and Pittsburgh looked okay. Baltimore had an easy time with Cincinnati. And I think Pittsburgh had a harder time with the Eagles than they probably should have. But the Eagles have their strength is pass rush. And the Eagles' problem is their number one receiver right now is Travis Fulgham. And I liked Travis Fulgham. I remember popping him, when he came out for the draft. But he's no one's number one receiver. He's a complimentary kind of guy. And he played really well, and Wentz found him really well. But they're not going to get far, with that kind of receiving core.
That is a good pop, Mike, because he was a 6th rounder from
for Detroit.
For Detroit, yeah. So deep dive at his ever, Carson. And is he going to be one of those players that everybody picks up on their fantasy waiver wire?
Never. Right. Well, it's worth it. It's worth a shot, because it's either him or Greg Ward.
Fair. 10 of 13 he caught for 152 yards and a touchdown, which on most days would have made him the star receiver in the game. But this wasn't most days, of course. Chase Claypool had an extraordinary performance. 4 touchdowns for the Steelers against the Eagles. Another wide receiver for the Pittsburgh Steelers in an organization that just seems to churn out elite receivers like they're going out of fashion. So Claypool, the latest name to add to that quite illustrious list over the last 10 or so years.
Yeah, and you know, that was big for them that he did step up because Deontay Johnson got hurt. I don't know what the prognosis, long-term prognosis is for him, but they will need him, but he's a different kind of receiver. Claypool physically looks a lot like a Mohamed Sanu.
Right.
But I think he's got better speed. And, you know, they used him in a couple of different ways, and he delivered each time. He now goes into the discussion of who's the greatest Canadian football player ever in the NFL.
Automatically.
It's not a long list on whether you count Bronco Nagurski, who was born in Canada, but usually isn't counted as a Canadian. Previously, it was either Dr. Duvernay-Tardif from the Chiefs or Nate Burleson.
Of course, Nate Burleson, yeah.
Who's Canadian, or a kicker. You know, you had John Ryan, the punter, or Mike Vanderjack, you know, the place kicker, who were Canadians. And there was the guy from McGill, my university, who was a long snapper, Le Ducier. I can try to think. It was JP or LP or something, yeah. Like Laurent Pierre or something like that. But, you know, yeah, there weren't that many Canadian-born guys who've had those kind of careers. So Claypool could become a living legend north of the border. And, you know, you don't have many guys who get four touchdowns in a game as a rookie. They were going through list after list, you know, of the rookies who've done it, the rookies who've done it since the Super Bowl, the rookie wide receivers who've done it, blah, blah, blah. But it was a great performance, which they needed to beat Philadelphia.
Yeah, they did. It was, as you alluded to earlier, Mike, it was tougher than maybe it should have been on paper. You mentioned Ruggs earlier on, CeeDee Lamb, Jefferson didn't step up yesterday, but has had some impressive starts. T. Higgins as well. A lot of rookie wide receivers, when this is a position that historically it's difficult to make an immediate impact in the NFL.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's changing a bit. And the reason it's changing is that pass routes are changing because the offenses are going more toward that college spread thing.
Right.
And you have more man-to-man matchups for the receiver to win. When you go back to the origins of those spread offenses, they were developed in colleges that were generally outmanned by their opposition. You know, lesser powers within major conferences, smaller colleges playing bigger ones, because it gave them a chance to get one or two playmakers and get them the ball, you know, and spread things out and lessen the advantage the bigger teams had. And as those come in to the NFL more and more, receivers have less kind of reading of defense to do. The hardest part for a college receiver coming into the NFL is reading defenses where you have routes that you run one way against man and another way against zone. The second hardest thing is that you don't have many really bad defensive backs that you're running against, because every team's got usually, you know, guys who were top quality college players.
Even the Jets.
Yeah. Good point. But, you know, we had six wide receivers in the first round. I think it was 13 in the first two rounds. The 13th was Denzel Mims going to the Jets, who of course hasn't made any impact. There's been a couple who've been hurt, but you know, you mentioned some of the names. Ruggs stepped up this week. Lamb obviously is playing like a number one guy. In fact, Amari Cooper is kind of their number three guy now. Behind him in Gallup.
Gallup, yeah.
T. Higgins.
Wilson's knocking on the door as well. Cooper could be four in the power rank.
Yeah. Claypool, obviously. Chenault had six or seven catches for, there's a couple of guys who've been hurt. Ayuk looks good for San Francisco. He looks like a really good fit for that offense. And then you've even got guys further down. Gabriel Davis for Buffalo has played really well, and he was, I think, a fourth round pick. And Duvernay in Baltimore. Who does a lot of things for them. And my favorite guy, actually, I think he was a fifth round, Quentin Cephas, simply because of his name. You know, did you Cephas what he did last week?
Sub-editors around the States.
Yeah, it's kind of like...
It doesn't exist anymore. I don't know if it does.
It's kind of like Darius, what's his name, in Indianapolis whenever he makes a play. You know, you cannot be Darius. The one other thing, just to mention, because I mentioned Baltimore, it just reminded me, an interesting anomaly for the Ravens was that they had five different defensive backs get sacks against Cincinnati.
Wow.
Which, this is one of those where someone with a bigger computer than I have needs to go back and see if that's the first time that that's ever happened in the NFL.
Well, let's find out to our listeners at the NC show. Iron Mike is calling you to action there. See if you can find that out for us. And we'll talk about it on the show later on this week.
Yeah, and I wish I had one of those big mainframe computers that the NFL has, which they're using now to figure out the schedule.
Yes, for the postgrad degree from MIT as well to boot. So let's try and work it out. So let's start with the easy stuff. The Broncos-Patriots game moved
to Tuesday.
Seven other games have been affected so far. So this is where it gets interesting. The Chiefs at Bills week 6 game moves from Thursday, October the 15th to Monday, October the 19th, right?
That's a huge one for the Chiefs. That, you know, rather than having to travel to Buffalo on a short week, they now travel to Buffalo on a long week. Mm. And that's going to make a whole, of all the games that have been switched, I think that's the one that you know, shows the most effect. But in reality, you know, this is only temporary. We're basically playing whack-a-mole here. Mm. And we have no idea of which teams are going to register more infections and register, you know, more days out of practice and player losses. It's really, we're incapable of predicting this. The league's incapable of predicting this. And I know they're doing is trying desperately to keep the season going.
Keep the train on the tracks. What's more likely, do you think, an extension to the season or a complete break from the season?
Well, currently they're talking, they have a week in reserve. They've sort of made plans to use week 18 to play games that need to be made up. And they obviously wouldn't play games that wouldn't affect the schedules. And I've heard talk that, you know, if they did affect the schedules and were unable to make a balanced schedule, they would simply go on winning percentage. And anomalies like the Chiefs getting a break on the Monday night, going from Thursday to Monday night, that you just have to live with that. You know, if you miss a game against the Jets and you then wind up having to play a game against the Steelers or whatever, you just have to live with that, which is fair enough given the situation. It's a situation I wouldn't want to be in, you know, because there's no good way of handling it.
So Mike, what happens in the playoffs, A, if we get that far, and B, if we have a game and on the Thursday before the Saturday game, Mahomes goes down with COVID, a superstar goes down with COVID. Is it just, we'll end the breaks and the Chiefs have to deal with it?
I think that's going to have to be the first thing is that those are the breaks. It's when, unless a large enough number go down, are infected so that the team couldn't play or couldn't safely play or you were in danger of, spreading the infection or something like that, you'd have to play. I suspect once you reach that situation, you're in a forfeit situation.
Yeah.
Where if the team can't play, can't produce enough players to play or have, you know, such a, if the infection, say, is spread to the coaches and ancillary staff and stuff like that, you'd be like what people are talking about with Tennessee right now, just forfeiting the game, which is tough in most cases, although in the Tennessee case, they're pointing to this private workout that the players had, which apparently is where the infection was spread. Since they broke the lockdown rules or whatever you want to call the rules, then a forfeit could be appropriate. But once you reach the playoff, I think it just has to be what it is. And, you know, hopefully we get that far. But, you know, you're starting to hear more and more players talking about not taking protection seriously enough, that the league and the Players Association both are not taking protection seriously enough. And I think we're probably going to have a revamping of the scheduling, because as we've seen in the U.S., even in the presidential thing, you know, next day testing doesn't really tell you much when you've got an incubation period of, you know, 2 to 5 days before you test positive.
Right.
And then who knows how much longer afterwards.
Right. Maestro Mike, we're out of time. Brilliant stuff as ever. Before we go, your Patreon column, you mentioned early stuff you've been writing about. Where can our listeners go to check
it out? Yeah, it's www.patreon.com, Mike Carlson, FMTE. I ought to know that. It's my column. It's www.patreon.com/Mike Carlson, FMTE. I've also got some stuff up on Medium, not much of which is football, but some of it's pretty interesting anyway.
Oh, we'll check that out. We'll try and dig some, send us some links, and we'll push that out on our social channels as
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Lovely stuff. Iron Mike, catch up with you soon, bud.
Okay, see you later.
Lovely stuff from Iron Mike. We will be checking in with him very, very soon. And we'll be checking back in with you very, very soon as well. Keep your eyes and ears peeled for bonus pods. We're going to be dropping a few of those over the next couple of weeks. And we'll be getting set for week 6 with Ben Isaacs. He is in the house Thursday. That's when the pod drops. We will see you then. Bye for now, gang.